Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. It has been a minute since we did one of these. Chris, it's good to have you back. You were traveling around this great nation of ours for a little while. And while you were gone, the Mets did nothing. But as soon as you got back, stuff started to happen at a furious pace. And the most relevant of those things is that earlier today it became official that Max Scherzer will spend the next 3 years, theoretically, as a Met. It's a three-year, $130 million contract. Is that correct?
Yep.
Sounded wrong coming out of my mouth. I had to double-check myself. 3 years, because it's so much money. 3 years, $130 million. Complete no-trade clause. Opt out after the second season. This is one of those things that there were rumors swirling, and I think, like many Mets fans, I said, that doesn't sound like something the Mets would do. And so I had convinced myself that this was just not a thing, and, you know, that's fine. Rumors are fun. And then it just kept building, and then by about 9 o'clock or 9:30 last night, it seemed like people were thinking, this could really be a thing. Then by about 10 o'clock last night, it seemed like, oh no, this is happening. But then we had to sit around and wait for another 13 or 14 hours until the deal was finally inked. But, I mean, how do you feel about the newest Met? I mean, it still seems totally inconceivable to me that this happened in the best possible way. How do you feel about this, Chris?
Yeah, no, and I don't think I had missed, you know, I'd been back from being out in the desert, sort of the first half of the month, but I'd been back from that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there was a Mets Scherzer rumor or anything really until yesterday, right?
I think people have been talking about just, you know, the Mets need starting pitching. Here are the big starting pitchers available. So he might have been,
right,
you know, listed in things like that. But I don't recall any conversations between the Mets and Scherzer being discussed until maybe it wasn't this weekend. Maybe it wasn't yesterday. Rather, maybe it was just the start of the, like, holiday weekend. But
yeah,
it all happened very quickly.
Yeah, yeah, and it's one of those things that maybe earlier in the offseason somebody like Heyman or Rosenthal or somebody might have mentioned his name. But until really last night, there wasn't anything going on that was linking them, you know, in a way that you'd expect it to come to this. But, like, holy shit, Max Scherzer on the Mets. Like, what? And you're right. It, you know, when you said it is a lot of money to us, and I'm assuming just about every person who listens to us. You know, if there's somebody out there who's listening, who doesn't think that's a lot of money, hi, Steve Cohen, I guess. You know,
right. And also, good for you, man, or woman,
yeah,
or person. Good for you that you can say that's not a lot of money.
But. But yeah, a friend of mine last night, and, you know, once some information started to come out, you know, one Mets fan friend in the furious texting that I'm sure all of us had going on, you know, among our Mets fan friends and family members and everything, had said, oh, $40 million is a lot of money. And I said, not when you have $16 billion or whatever it is, you know, just lying around. Like, Steve Cohen has still bought art, like single pieces of art that are, depending on your taste in art, maybe surprisingly or shockingly worth more than what Max Scherzer is getting paid in this contract. You know, whatever your thoughts are on the economic situation in the United States, if you're going to have an ultra billionaire, he or she may as well own your favorite sports team.
Yeah.
You know, because then things like this can happen and you can say to your friends, I don't care. Okay, sure. $40 million. Yeah, that's a ton of money. But it's not ours. It's not our money. And yeah, it's pretty great. And, you know, Scherzer is somebody who has not slowed down at all. You know, he's 37. and really put together a very fine season. I think somebody pointed out today, and something I probably should have noticed just looking looking at the stats pages myself, that it was actually his best single season ERA.
Wow.
Of his career. You know, albeit in slightly fewer innings than some of his Cy Young winning years, when he was, you know, well over 200 innings and putting up sub three ERAs, which he's done, aside from the shortened COVID season in 2020, he's had a sub three ERA every year since 2015 and every year except for one since 2013. It's just a remarkable level of consistency. You know, the velocity is still sitting pretty much exactly where it has. You know, this is it's like getting double to the ground.
Yes.
The strikeout rates are great. He doesn't really walk anybody. You know, when you look at that kind of pitcher, that kind of track record, this is as exciting as it gets. And it's not someone in a million years that I ever would have thought would pitch for the Mets.
No. Yeah. You know, go ahead. Sorry.
Or if he did, it would have been like the Pedro years, which no disrespect. Pedro put up some good numbers for like a season and a half with the Mets, but you know, his career was sort of winding down, you know? So if somebody like A. Scherzer was going to come to the Mets, you know, especially before ownership changed, you would think it would be like, okay, you know, he's 39 or he's 41 and he's still pitching, but he's got like a 3.90 ERA and he's a big name, but he's not what he used to be. But I think at the age of 37 now, and honestly, you know, a 3-year contract, there's an opt out after the second year, whether it's 2 or 3 years that he stays, there's no reason right now to think that he can't just keep being the guy that we know he is.
Well, here's the thing. Even if these are his Pedro years, to use the term that you just coined, if he declines at the rate that Pedro declined from the start of his Mets contract, Scherzer doesn't like slam his foot into the rubber the way that Pedro did, which caused a foot injury, which is what began to sort of slow Pedro down a little bit in his time in Queens. So if he just regresses, you know, 20%, 25% each of the next two seasons, he's still probably the best or second best starting pitcher on the market the Mets could have signed this offseason. A Scherzer at 25%, at 75%, I would take over Gossman, I would take over Ray, I would take over anyone that was out there. Now, I'm saying this all in a vacuum, and we also have to recognize that the Mets have the uncanny ability to sign a guy and then he just shits the bed forever. You know, see Bay, Jason for, you know, an example of that is the most clear one. But, you know, I understand the skepticism of signing a guy in his late 30s. You know, I am older than Max Scherzer. Some people are calling him an old man. Fuck you, I guess, because I am a couple years older than Scherzer is. So if he's an old man, I don't know what that makes me. But regardless, you know, I think the point remains. I think that even if Scherzer declines a little bit, he is still a very good starting pitcher and is a starting pitcher that the Mets is a better starting pitcher than anyone on the Mets not named Jacob DeGrom most likely will be in 2022. If he doesn't decline at that rate, then the Mets have the best 1-2 punch in baseball as long as they're healthy, bar none. Like, there is no team that comes close to DeGrom and Scherzer. And here's the other thing.
No, and not even thing. Close.
Yeah, it's hilarious how good those two would be together if they're both healthy. And here's the thing. Their presence on the team protects the other one in a way where if DeGrom is hurt again this year, which God forbid that happens, I think, you know, we tend to hang out in a very cynical corner of the Mets internet. And so I think people are saying like, oh, DeGrom's toast. He's always hurt. That's very recent history that DeGrom is always hurt, right? And last year was a weird year. So if DeGrom and Scherzer, if one of them gets hurt, we still have one of the two best pitchers in baseball starting for us. If neither gets hurt, We still have the best two pitchers in baseball. Like, this is such an important move for this franchise. And it's a move that really doesn't cost them anything. I was talking to my brother before, and I said, think about how insane this is. The Mets added, and we'll talk about these guys later, two outfielders, an infielder, and one of the top four pitchers in baseball without trading a single player. They got this all just based on Steve Cohen's money. And every contract is a contract for 3 or less years, which means that even if these contracts all are terrible and the players all start playing like Frank Francisco when he was in Pinstripes, right? If all these go tits up, it's okay because we didn't give up anything to get them. It's just Steve Cohen's money. There is almost no downside to making these moves to me. The only downside is if you're prioritizing these players over other players and you firmly believe that Kevin Gausman is a better fit for the Mets than Max Scherzer, which I understand the idea behind wanting a younger pitcher who is less likely to hit a cliff or to fall off a cliff, rather, because of age. I understand all that, but it's not your money. And if it's not your money, then you should have fun with it. Like, I always think about this. The first time I ever went to a casino, I put like a quarter in a slot machine and I won $20. And then I just took insane chances with that $20 because it was lucky money I found. It didn't impact my bottom line at all, so I could have fun and enjoy myself with that little bit of money. That's what being a Mets fan is when Steve Cohen is the owner. It's not your money. Let him – you can, as a fan, root for and enjoy crazy things because you don't have to worry about it. I really truly believe after a lifetime of stingy, shitty ownership.
Right, after intensely worrying about it, after an era in which some reporting had said that even the general manager didn't know what his budget was during off seasons that he was in charge of.
Right.
it's crazy. And combined with, and I don't want to make a great day for the Mets about the Yankees, but it's just part of feeling bizarre as a New York baseball fan. The Yankees signed Jose Peraza to a minor league deal today, and the Mets signed Max Scherzer to a record annual value contract. And the Yankees weren't even in on Scherzer. That just feels so bizarre.
It does
across the board.
I should say too, we got a very nice email from our friends at True Blue LA, the Dodgers podcast, who said congratulations, then called me a jerk, and then said that the Mets won the essentially the Dodgers lost, the Dodgers won the wrong bidding war with the Mets. And when you think about it, if the Mets had just pushed a little bit harder, Trevor Bauer would have been a Met this past year, and this definitely wouldn't happen then. Thank goodness the Mets didn't go after Trevor Bauer as hard as they wanted to.
Right. Yeah, they certainly tried, but if they're going to learn the ropes and go for it for somebody, it is obviously far, far, far better that they figure that shit out now.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, Scherzer changes everything, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, no, he really does. I mean, I don't know. Like, to have those two guys who are that caliber, that's 40% of your rotation. That is substantial. And obviously, you know, and we'll talk about some of the other moves the Mets have made recently here, but they could use a little bit more middle of the rotation help. I don't know that we should be doom and gloom about all of Taijuan Walker after his second half struggles and Carlos Carrasco after really not putting it together at all this year, or David Peterson or Tylor McGill. You might be able to piece together a fairly nice rotation behind these two with what you already have, but I think it's pretty fair that the consensus is that they should do a little bit more in between. You know, it certainly doesn't seem like that's going to be Marcus Stroman coming back. I mean, never rule anything out until it actually happens, especially now that we've entered a new era.
But that would be one of the stranger returns based on the last couple of days of Twitter.
Right. Yeah, no. When the player is tweeting about the team not wanting him and preferring other pitchers, and then it signs one of those pitchers, you know, he's doing it in sort of an open way with that. And then he gets into it with Mark Carrig. I'd say still a friend of the podcast. It's been a minute since we've had him on.
Absolutely.
But
I went to college with his wife. He is forever a friend of the pod.
Yes. So Mark happened to catch that Stroman liked, you know, a tweet that had an ethnic slur in there, and called him out for it and screenshotted it. And then Stroman, for those of you who are blissfully not on Twitter,
God bless Stroman. If you're not on Twitter, I really envy you.
Yes. Although it gave me something to do on the ride home from Thanksgiving weekend last night.
That's true.
I was not driving. So I was just pulling down in Tweetbot over and over and over. But yeah, if you didn't catch it, so correctly calls him out, and then Stroman tries to say it's photoshopped and whatever, and it's a whole thing, and that's just bullshit because Carrig took the screenshot and saw it himself, and is a reputable baseball reporter, to say the least. I think he's not even technically a reporter now; he's moved up a couple slots over at The Athletic, but. That sort of Twitter behavior, and it's so weird. It's messed up that other online behaviors by players like Bauer, and he's really the prime example of it. But you know, some of that stuff doesn't get flagged as much, but the player, you know, complaining about the process while he's a free agent. And then, you know, the issue that Carrig brought up, you know, those are things that should catch the attention of front offices and understandably will probably cost that player significant amounts of money. Mm-hmm. But it's just messed up that Bauer didn't get that sort of treatment as well, you know?
Right.
So, yeah. Anyway, that's been the Stroman part of things. But, yeah. Hopefully they can get somebody else in between. But it's hard to, like, dwell on anything, really, right now. Because it's just nobody's going in and starting pitchers that, you know, opening day and the second game of the season are slated to be two guys who are huge draws. And you know, not that I think that Steve Cohen and the front office are making decisions to try to sell tickets, you know, specifically for one player, but I would expect that, you know, that first start for each of those two, that Citi Field will be pretty packed.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. I was even thinking about, try to do that whole series maybe. And I didn't go to many games last year. I'm, you know, and I'm not the guy to go to multiple games in a weekend, but that's just too fun to pass up, I think.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you this question because you and I have been Mets fans for approximately the same amount of time, a couple of years difference. But I'm sure that you were one of the folks, or maybe you weren't, maybe you're a better person than I am, who said things like, you know, my team doesn't buy championships when talking about the Yankees, right? Because when we were growing up, the Yankees were just dominating in every way. Does this feel like buying a championship? And if so, does this feel weird to you at all? Or are you just like, fuck it, man. We have Cohen's money. Let's spend it.
Well, yeah, no, I think I was of that same mind at some point previously. But over the years, I think my approach and our approach, and then I think it's just sort of the tone around the sport, because baseball has been so incredibly successful financially, I think it's been easier for people to realize, like, I'm not saying it's because we are in our 30s. I think there's some very young people out there who love baseball, who see things for what they are, you know, right now, despite being younger. But people are, I don't know, just more cognizant of the fact that there's a ton of money in this game. And, you know, these owners who try to act like they're small market and whatever. If you own a Major League Baseball team or any other major sports team anywhere, really, certainly in this country, you probably have so much money. And whether or not you decide to invest in player payroll is it's a decision entirely on you. You know, this isn't, and I realize saying this out loud, I'm like, oh, this could sound like rationalizing it because now we're, you know, we're in this spot. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with wanting your favorite team to get the best players. And in all likelihood, you know, it's not like we're talking about, let's just say, the city of Oakland. It's not like they're owned by the, it's not like the A's are owned by the city of Oakland. You know, right. There's somebody with a shit ton of money behind, everything that goes on who owns that franchise and decides to run it the way they decide to run it. So I think if it was still, if we were in the year 2000, you know, 2005, six, seven, eight, nine. I mean, the Mets payrolls weren't small then, but yeah, there was still that like anti-Yankees stigma out there that like, oh, they just buy their championships. But then, I think then everybody just realized, well, like, why is that wrong?
Right. Especially because every time the Mets have tried to do that, it has failed miserably.
Right.
Look at the worst team money can buy. Look at the, was it 2002, the Mo Vaughn, Robbie Alomar, Jeremy Burnett's experiment, right? Like, the Mets have tried to do exactly what the Yankees did. The Mets just are bad at it, and historically bad at it.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, no, so it doesn't, to me, it doesn't feel cheapened. It's, one, let's just hope that they, you know, win a championship, and then we can have people saying to us that they bought it. And we can just say, yeah, that happened. And it was great.
Exactly.
But yeah, no, it's just, it's not on us to do that. And I think, you know, part of the reason why it was so easy to feel that way, was that, to their credit, the Yankees and some other teams were sort of just ahead of the curve with stuff. You know, there's so much sentiment in sports that like, oh, this guy's overpaid, he's not going to be worth his contract, blah blah blah. And then like you know, being Mets fans specifically under the Wilpon ownership group, especially when it really became their show, and then their post Madoff show, you would say things when Mookie Betts was on the market, on the trade market. If you said, oh, the Mets should trade for him and extend him and pay him, you know, exactly the same recipe that they followed with Lindor. But if you said that, a significant percentage of Mets fans would be like, well, that's not realistic, so shut up, don't say that. But like,
right.
As a fan, yeah, you should want your team to take advantage of that kind of a situation. And like, just because the owners are inept or incapable or both, that doesn't mean you should just, you know, belittle other fans for thinking that that would be a good idea. So yeah, in that spirit, it is very nice to be on the other side of this stuff. And I will say, you know, even just in the last few days, I hope this is the end of, you know, overly negative reactions when, you know, this little spree that the Mets just went on started with Eduardo Escobar, who's a fine player. His last three full-length seasons you know, he had a weird 2020, but who didn't?
Who didn't? Yeah.
You know, three full seasons, all three or more wins above replacement, according to Fangraphs. I'm sure similar to that on Baseball Reference and anywhere else. You know, but that move happens and it's like, oh no, here we go. You know, it just happens to be the first one. And there's concern that like, oh, that's the off season. And, it very much is not.
No.
So that, you know, I don't expect that the Mets will spend this much, every off season. I don't think they'll end up with a $600 million payroll, but I think they've at least helped feel like it's a significant changing of the guard from the past. I mean, I think Lindor did that in a significant way too, because just, you know, the Betts comparison, if nothing had changed, the Wilpons never would have traded for Lindor, and they never would have extended him even if they did. And, you know, I'm sure there's some Mets fans out there who worry that he's overpaid. But guess what? Also not our money.
Yep, exactly. Well, that was going to be my point, which was that I don't think that this is going to be the way that Steve Cohen's going to operate the team for the totality of his ownership. I just think that when the team has been so fucking mismanaged, I mean, look, first it was mismanaged because of the Wilpons and their business acumen or lack thereof. Then you could argue that Brody Van Wagenen came in, a guy without any front office experience. Very nice guy. Was nice to both of us. But, you know, a guy who was not necessarily trained in this way and made some moves that, you know, some worked out, some didn't work out so well for him. And, you know, but was still a very dysfunctional franchise. And then last year, in the midst of COVID and all that, Cohen comes in, the two GM disasters. Like the only way the Mets were going to compete in 2022, man, fucking years keep moving by. Only way they're going to compete in 2022 is if they go big this offseason. Because let me tell you something. If you're thinking that Jeff McNeil is going to be the best hitter on your team again, or if you're thinking that Carlos Carrasco can bounce back to where he was, I hope both those things happen, but there is no guarantee of those things. And so the Mets needed to do a couple of things that would put them in a position where they could not only improve the team for this year, but also undo some of the mistakes of the last couple of years. And the only way to do that was to spend a lot of money. And so I'm glad Cohen did this. I don't think that Cohen is necessarily going to spend this much money every year. I hope he doesn't, because eventually that luxury tax will hurt the team a little bit. And what does that mean, hurt the team? I don't even know, right? When Cohen has this much money, it's hard to know what actually hurts the team. It'll hurt them with things like draft picks and, you know, that sort of thing. So I hope that this isn't how they operate every year. But I think for this year, it's a fine way to operate. And I don't care if you say that is me just making myself feel better, because this is what's happening to my team right now, but I don't care. We have Max fucking Scherzer and Jacob DeGrom at the front of our franchise right now.
Yeah.
Should we talk about some other guys?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
So of the three players the Mets signed, who do you have the most to say about? Let's start there.
I think I have the most to say about Escobar. So we'll start there. Yeah. So as longtime listeners of the podcast know, my cousin is a diehard Twins fan, and therefore I have above average familiarity with Twins players, you know, among Mets fans. An American League team that is best known for losing to the Yankees in the playoffs. You know, a lot of NL East fans might not really, you know, pay that close of attention to the Twins, but you know, that's why I was a little extra excited for Trevor May when he came over to the Mets in the offseason last year. So yeah, Escobar fits that role, that description. And you know, I also grew up not too far from the then affiliate of the Twins. in Double A. Escobar, I think, I highly doubt. Okay, so I'm educating myself a little bit here. he didn't even come up through the Twins system for the most part. He had been in the White Sox system, but then made it as a Twin. So anyway, I did not see him play as a minor leaguer, but because of my Twins, you know, connections in my mind, somebody who, you know, who I had some knowledge of for quite a while, and you know, he's a guy who had been a little up and down in his time in Minnesota. They send him to Arizona, and again, you know, 2020 was definitely a down year, but it was like a third of the plate appearances he usually makes over the course of a full season, even a little less than a third. In his last three full seasons, the dude can hit, and he's not going to be the best hitter on the team, I hope. I mean, if he happens to have that great of a year and everybody else is good, cool. But you know, this is somebody who's got some pop in his bat. Arizona's pretty hitter friendly. So I don't, you know, I don't want to say that he's going to replicate the, you know, on average mid to upper 20s home runs per season when he's playing his games in Citi Field, and ideally, you know, not in an everyday role all the time. We'll see where else the Mets go with their position players, either on the free agent market or in trades. And, you know, we're all operating, obviously, with the pace of things right now in free agency, everyone's operating under the assumption that the owners will implement a lockout when the CBA expires on December 1st. And then who knows how long it'll be before, you know, transactions can happen again. So, yeah, all of that said, Escobar is somebody, if he's pressed into an everyday role, I can't say that I've watched him enough to know what his defense looks like at second or third. I'd imagine it's not spectacular at short at this point. You know, he's only going into his age 33 season, but just the fact that other teams have had him playing, you know, non-shortstop infield positions primarily, you know, that's something that I would expect isn't going to be great if he's out there at short. But I do think it's somebody who has a bat that's good enough that he can carry a starting spot if he's pressed into it. I know not everybody at Amazing Avenue would agree with that, but I'm fond of the signing. You know, the 2-year deal at a reasonable by major league player standards salary. I like you said at the beginning about all of these contracts, you know, short-term deals with an ultra billionaire owner backing the team, if they don't pan out, then so be it. But I think, you know, this is a nice solid hitter, and somebody who should be, you know, exciting to watch. He's not a huge stolen base guy, but you know, he hits his fair share of doubles and throws in some triples. I know Arizona's got some parts of the park that can help with that, but so does Citi Field.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's going to be really interesting to see if the Mets bring back Jonathan Villar at this point.
Right.
I think those two guys kind of are duplicating skills if they're on the team together, but I think both of them work better in part-time roles. So maybe if you use them, not as a platoon, but if you were able to just mix and match them so that they're not, so that one isn't playing every day, that might actually be a very good thing for the team. But I don't know how high on the priority list that is right now. Is that something you would even consider doing?
Yeah, definitely consider. You know, they've got, like right now, if you look at likely starters and bench players, they've got a little bit of an overload of lefties, left-handed hitters, I should say, that would be on the bench. I don't think anybody would be surprised if they make some trades. And not that they necessarily have to, but if they made some trades involving either Dom Smith or JD Davis, who's a right-handed hitter, of course.
Or Jeff McNeil, maybe.
Right. Even McNeil. You know, if they're going to trade McNeil, they definitely have to have somebody else come in to help play second or third, one or two guys, you know, because, you know, depending on what your thoughts are on Escobar playing one of those positions every day, or, you know, whether or not Robinson Cano makes it back at all. And, you know, we're all assuming there's going to be a designated hitter in the National League moving forward. And if there is, obviously, you would think that Cano would benefit from spending a lot of time there. But it opens up a little bit of, you know, flexibility in terms of getting guys rest and all that. But yeah, Jonathan Villar, and it's no disrespect to anybody else on the roster, but, you know, somebody who can give you just flexibility in the field and at the plate that maybe Dom Smith can't. You know, maybe you bring that guy back, and maybe there's somebody out there who can get Dom into sort of an everyday first base or DH role, you know, where you're not making the dude go out and play the outfield. Then maybe you can, you know, just find a good match where he can go play and you get something back in return that can help the Mets, you know, this year and maybe even beyond. So, yeah. And it sucks because, you know, Dom is very likable, but you look at, and we'll touch base on the other two guys the Mets brought in on Friday. But you just look at this stuff and it's kind of like, well, where does Dom get playing time that he fits?
See, I've been thinking a lot about this. I think of JD, Dom, and McNeil. I have the most confidence in Dom's hit tool from anyone else in that connection. Like I don't feel good enough about any of those players' other skills. I don't feel as good about any of those players' other skills as they do about Dom's hit tool. And so I think that makes Dom both the most attractive to trade, but also the one that might sting the most if you do trade him away and he does play every day with another club, you know. But I think that the argument for keeping Dom Smith would be that, well, first of all, none of those three are very good outfielders. McNeil is the best of the three by far. But both Brandon Nimmo and, to a large degree, a lot of the team has had injury problems in the past, right? And
yeah,
you want to have a couple of players in reserves to help you for when those players get hurt, because they're probably going to get hurt at some point. And I think that expecting Robinson Cano to be able to hit at all is a tall order. I mean, he hasn't played baseball in a year. I know he played in one of the winter leagues, but apparently he got hurt, I think, in one of the winter leagues, I had heard. So
yeah, some back tightness recently.
And yeah.
Sort of, you know, it's just the way it goes.
Exactly. So I would think that, like, if you're looking for a guy to DH, I think Dom makes the most sense as the DH.
He would make the most Smith too.
Yeah, he would. Thanks. Thanks for putting that out. I appreciate that. I'm just teasing.
I know. But after we had our dreams of like making Photoshop versions of the Smiths album covers of all the different Smiths,
yes,
wound up on the opening day roster this year, I couldn't help but catch that. That almost came out.
I appreciate that. Yes. but no, I mean, you know, it's a. I think that he would make the most sense if you're not counting on Cano. I think you keep Dom as your DH because he can fill in for Pete. If Pete gets hurt, he can, in a pinch, play left field for you, and he can DH for you most days. I think you would lose the least at first base or DH with Dom as in that position as opposed to JD or McNeil.
Yeah.
But honestly, they're going to have to trade two or three of those guys, I think, if they want to field the team that they are trying to field, which... you know, the word is that the Mets are still in on Javi Baez, which is the craziest part of all of this to me, that the that Cohen is still willing to possibly shell out for Javi Baez in this situation. But anyway,
right.
we still have two more guys to talk about. I guess we'll talk about Mark Canna.
Sure, yeah.
Is that how you pronounce it, by the way? I don't think I've ever heard anyone say his name out loud.
Yeah, that would be my best guess. Canna, I guess, would be the other guess.
I think it's Canna. I think.
Yeah.
But I'm not totally certain about that. But, you know, this is a guy that our own Lucas Vlahos is very high on, who has been calling for his signing all offseason. And it's an interesting signing because he's not young. You know, he's in his early 30s, but he's the model of hitting consistency, and he is a high OBP guy. He's a better defensive outfielder than anyone not named Brandon Nimmo that the Mets had on the roster last year. He makes a lot of sense for this team. He's not the flashiest signing, but I think that he's going to fit in pretty well. How do you feel about Canna?
Good. I know just getting the one concern out of the way up front. Some people had pointed out that he had sort of tailed off a little bit in the 2021 season and has had some on and off like hip issues. But you're still looking at a guy that in the last three full seasons that have happened, he's been, 411, 497, 625 plate appearances, and played almost every game except one in the shortened season in 2020. So I'm not saying he's the perfect example of durability, but he also isn't somebody who's, really missed a ton of time with injury. And over the last four seasons, he's just been a well above average hitter. Like Escobar, it's been a little higher peaks and a little lower on the, I don't even want to say valley, but on the lower end of his range in terms of wins above replacement. But, this is somebody who has been certainly a positive contributor to the A's for the last few years. His single season best is a .273 batting average. Don't expect him to hit that, and that's fine. He's going to get on base a lot. He's got some pop in the bat. He's not going to lead the team in home runs or anything. This is just like a solid dude. It's almost, I don't know why, and like I have not seen him play enough, so don't take this as me saying that his game looks like. But for whatever reason, I'm just looking at him. I'm comparing him to like what Xavier Nady was at his best when he was a Met. I mean that as a compliment.
That glorious half season of Xavier Nady as a Met.
Was it really only that long?
It was. It feels so much longer. He signed that offseason, and he was traded for Roberto Hernandez in the middle of the season.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
I was like, I would have bought a Xavier Nady jersey had I been able to afford one at that time. It's what, as a right out of college shithead.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm going to rescind that.
No, it's despite, a good comp. I love Xavier Nady.
Despite that, I'll put my expectations a little more at like Cliff Floyd as a Met.
Okay. Yeah. I'm down with that.
That's a little bit better. Floyd was definitely a higher average hitter. There's some differences in the game there. Floyd hit over 30 home runs a couple times. So we'll leave it at that. I think Canna is, in my mind, I'm hoping for a perfect blend of Xavier Nady and Cliff Floyd.
I'd sign up for that.
Yeah, but a solid, again, a solid major league hitter. And I think it's, we'll talk about the third guy too. But I think as we talk about this stuff, it's, there's the individual merits of each player. And then there's also just the idea that, whatever role they end up in, there are some new faces. One of the things that Mets fans, I think, have gotten a little, fed up with is not making enough changes, not bringing in new faces when you go outside the organization. This is definitely that. Adding these caliber of hitters and overall players to a Mets core that certainly underperformed offensively in 2021, but like Nimmo, Lindor, Alonso, these are dudes who can hit. I know people might have feelings about some of that, but
my big thing with Canna is that, well, there's two things. The first is that he's an actual outfielder. The Mets have not had actual outfielders patrolling all three outfield positions in a very long time. He's an actual outfielder. So kudos to them for that. And secondly, I just think that one of the things that the Mets struggled with last year was not even getting the big hit when they needed, because every team goes through struggles with that. The Mets just couldn't hit last year. And they couldn't get on base, and it was a very frustrating thing to watch. And so he seems like a guy who, even if he's not at his best, like you were saying, if he's a 255, 260 hitter, but he's getting on base at a decent clip, has a little bit of pop, and can play an actual outfield position, that is a very good thing for the Mets. And then they went and got Starling Marte, who's an actual center fielder. Not since Angel Pagan, Chris, has an actual center fielder roamed the grass at Citi Field. It's been a long time.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of funny. Somebody last night, I forget who, and understandably, because everybody on Mets Twitter was tweeting, or maybe it was even this morning, I don't know, but somebody brought up, like, 10 years ago, this was the offseason that happened, and it was, just a screenshot writing about, like, when they traded Pagan away, and, I don't even remember the name of the relief pitcher, but the relief pitcher and then Torres,
Andres Torres, yes,
a couple other, the whole offseason was so little.
They got Ramon Ramirez in that trade as well.
Yes. Okay. Right. But yeah. It's just funny because Pagan had come up in that context, and then you you are correct. We've seen guys forced to play out there. Typically hasn't gone exceedingly well. Like Cespedes at his best, when they had him in center and he was just mashing the ball, I didn't care if, like,
right, of course,
the defense wasn't perfect, and it wasn't center field defense that cost them the World Series that year either. Some unfortunate late game pitching situations and some really bad infield defense. Just the idea of somebody who can hold down center field and be a good to great hitter. This is Marte's one of his best years as a hitter. He hit .310. 383 on base percentage. Those are both career highs. Not his highest slugging, but he's coming off a great season. If he doesn't do exactly that, that's also okay. But yeah, an actual center fielder who can hit, and in 2 years, if he's not an actual center fielder anymore, this is a dude who stole 47 bases this year. He had done that once before in his career. You just fast guys who can play center field in a year or two, barring like crazy injury situations. It's usually pretty comfortable to move them to a corner and assume that that's going to go okay. So, if that needs to happen at some point during this deal, then we can wonder who the next good hitting actual center fielder is, but pretty excited that he's going to be the one to start this season and hopefully the next two, three, or all four in that spot.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that all of these are really good moves. The Mets should be praised for once for doing things that feel like the things that winning baseball teams do. I know that sounds very simple and possibly even condescending, but I feel like the team just hasn't had a plan in a while. That's one of the things that was being talked about in the Mason Avenue Slack this weekend. Somebody said the Mets' plan is to improve their defense and improve their starting pitching. And they've done both of those things really well so far. And I can't remember the last time the Mets had that clear of an offseason plan and then executed that plan that well. So yeah. I'm a happy man. This is good.
Yeah.
I mean, the Mets might be terrible this year. Scherzer might somehow throw a pitch, and as he throws it, his arm falls off, and then that arm hits Jacob deGrom in the head and concusses him, and everything is fucked again. But for right now, things are good, and I'm happy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Hell yeah, man. This is, I'm expecting a monster year out of Lindor. Pete Alonso mashing dingers and hopefully just destroying the home run derby. I want him to do it every year and treat it the way he did this year for as long as he plays baseball. This might sound selfish, but I want people to go in feeling like they don't even have a chance and it's just Pete Alonso's domain.
yes.
But Pete Alonso hitting bombs, Lindor, I think, has several great seasons left in him. We know he's capable of that. And he rebounded pretty nicely, you know, for like when the injury really puts a dent in this argument. But after those ice cold couple of months to start the season at the plate, he was pretty much the player that we were all super excited for.
Right. Yeah.
The rest of the way. You know, you're coming in, you are the guy, it's your first year, you're in a new city. I think sometimes the whole the media market, New York City, I think a lot of times that's us in New York maybe overblowing it a little bit, how important that is to the situation, but it's still a major life change. You know, you're living in a new place, you're on a massive contract. Not the first guy to maybe not have his best year under those circumstances, but not, I know I just mentioned the home run derby, but not that you're building a team to try to like get a number of guys on the all-star team and into the home run derby. But you know, you look at this roster and it's at least possible that anywhere from like 6 to 8 of these guys could be at the all-star game.
Yeah.
And that's not how you win a World Series, but I don't know. A couple weeks ago, I don't know that you would have had that thought. So yeah, just something that's exciting. It's getting cold. We're in the third darkest week of the year. Well, tied with the corresponding one on the other end, but you know, it's dark. It's cold. You may have seen some snow flurries, depending on exactly where you are. This is always a nice time of year to have exciting baseball news. And obviously, I don't want there to be a lockout every year. But if baseball could figure out a way to incentivize having a sort of like off-season frenzy like all the other sports do, that would be nice. Yes. Because this has been fun. Obviously, we're rooting for a team that's been super active, but lots of major things have happened in the span of the last few days, and baseball fans feel engaged. And depending on how long the lockout lasts and it takes to get a new agreement in place between the union and the league, spring training is not that far away. And a lot of people are very excited about baseball right now. Which is good. That's a good thing for the sport.
Yes, it is. One last bit of Mets-related news is that They have a new GM after all of this, and we haven't even mentioned the name Billy Epler once. But he is the new GM. He is the formerly disgraced GM from the Angels. I say disgraced only slightly, tongue-in-cheek. He is he hired Mickey Callaway. That, he has that going for him. He was GM when Tyler Skaggs died of a drug overdose, sold to him by a team employee. You know, I'm not saying that both of those things are explicitly his fault, but those are not great marks to have on your resume. And I don't think he was anybody's first choice, nor do I think the Mets were his first choice. And this is very much a marriage of convenience for both sides. That said, since Billy Epler is GM, the Mets have signed four good players. So who's to tell? Who can know if this is good or bad?
Yeah.
That's all I got. Do you have any hot Billy Epler takes?
No. I mean, I think it's more than fair to bring up those significant issues, excuse me, from, you know, the Angels' tenure. From a Mets perspective, I think it's just the fact that they got somebody into the job, somebody who has experience, you know, running a front office, and has that work that he had done for the Yankees before joining the Angels. You know, again, not to make today about the Yankees, but they do a lot of things well. You know, they have not been a World Series championship machine like they market themselves and like their fans think they should be. But they've been a highly competitive team. And, you know, I think working under Brian Cashman for some period of time is probably a good influence. You know, whatever your thoughts are on exactly what the Yankees have done on the field. Yeah, there's a good background there. and you know, we'll see. We'll see how things go. But it definitely feels like, it's not to put him down, I'm sure he's been involved in all of these things. But if you have a sense of what the job is and you come in and have the financial support to be able to do the things that they've been doing, that definitely makes the role a lot more comfortable to adjust to.
Absolutely. Well, Chris, we've talked about the Mets for the longest we've talked about the Mets in a long time. Means it's time for our music pick. What is your pick for this week?
So on our little tour of the Southwest, we ended up back at Desert Days. It's been the source of many music recommendations on this podcast from the two previous times that we attended. So this year it was a scaled down version, both in terms of the you know, the number of people in attendance, and then the number of stages, which is one instead of three, and therefore the number of bands. But it was still, you know, just like the concept 12 months ago, 6 months ago, even, you know, the concept of like being at a music festival sounded almost impossible. So it you know, it was very cool to get to do that in a way that felt COVID safe. And with that, the lineup this year, not totally up my alley as much as like the last two times, but there were some bands that I saw for the first time, or at least knowingly for the first time. Sometimes it happens if you go to enough things that you may have seen a band and just yes. didn't quite connect. So La Luz is the band whose album I'm recommending. They put out a record, I think it was in October, but certainly recently, either September, October. And it is, I believe it's just self-titled. Let's make sure I'm actually saying that correctly since it's, yeah. Yep. It's just self-titled La Luz, all women in the band. Like a definitely surfy sound and influence sort of throughout what they do. And I'm just going with the most recent record here because it's the one that I've listened to after seeing them. And like any band, you know, they played a good amount of it during their set. which was very enjoyable. So yeah, that's my rec. I don't know if it's the best December, you know, because we're almost there. I don't know if it's like the best December music, but if you're in warm weather, or if you just want to feel like you need to be like transported to warm weather,
it's aspirational.
Yeah, there you go. Or you could listen to it once right now and go, oh hey, that's a record for you know, when it does get warm, and right. And then come back to it then. But yeah, definitely one of my favorite new to me bands that I saw there, and a nice enjoyable record. So
very cool.
Give it a shot.
So I am going to go with a live music experience as well. I had been to a couple of shows this late summer, early fall. I saw Lou Barlow on tour, which I know Chris caught the same tour. And then I went to go see The Bad Plus play at a jazz club in the city at Joe's Pub. But I went to my first like sweaty rock show of the pandemic a few weeks ago, and that was at White Eagle Hall in Jersey City to see Titus Andronicus, a New Jersey band from Bergen County, New Jersey, where I grew up as well. And it was the 11th anniversary, because of course COVID messed up all the 10th anniversary shows and tours, the 11th anniversary of their record The Monitor. The Monitor is one of the most ambitious records I can think of. It is both an album about the band and also an album about the Civil War, which is like an audacious thing for a band to do on their second album, to make it a Civil War themed album. But that is what Titus Andronicus did. And they had an opening band whose name I've already forgotten, who was very enjoyable, and I should probably look that up because I enjoyed them. But once their set ended, they started playing like instrumental music from the Ken Burns Civil War documentary as the stage was being set for the show, just like the guitars being tuned, and it was excellent. And they ended the two songs before they came out, where they played the Battle Hymn of the Republic and then Civil War by Guns N' Roses, which was amazing. And then they came out, they did like a little short set beforehand, and then they did the whole album. And it's weird. I think like 10 years ago, I would have been bummed out about the show, because it seemed very staged to me, in that like there was kind of a costume change. Like, he changes his shirt a couple times. The lead singer, Patrick Stickles, changed his shirt a few times. And like there was a little segment where he's accompanied just by a piano, and they had a guy come out and set up like a fake bar, and he sat at the bar and talked to the bartender for a bit and then sang a song. It was very much a show, in the sense of it was like a very performative performance makes me want to shoot myself in the fucking head, but you know what I'm talking about. Like, it was a very
right.
considered show. It wasn't just like a band up there and kind of working without a set list or jamming. Like, it was very considered. But that album is such that I think it really delivered the album in a really great way. And if you haven't heard the album, it's just an amazing, amazing record. The first three songs take up something like 22 minutes, because they're just these long epic songs, but they're incredible. They're great. It's a band that I saw once a very long time ago, and then I wanted to see them on subsequent tours, and it just didn't happen for whatever reason. And so this is a really nice way to both see them and to dip my toe back into live music. The venue was great, you know, very COVID safe, and you know, overall, I just felt it was a good experience getting back to a show. And who knows when I'll get to another one. I had to give up a ticket this week to a show because I'm going away for work, and so it's gonna be a minute before I get to another show. But I was very glad I got to do this one. But if you haven't heard The Monitor by Titus Andronicus, that is my pick for this week.
Nice. Yeah, no, I've never heard anybody come out and say like, "Hey, this next song is about the Civil War."
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's like the album has like. They had a bunch of musicians record like spoken word parts that are parts of like Lincoln's Gettysburg Address and all these things. It's incredibly ambitious for a band whose first album is like a very straight ahead punk record. And like, okay, well, the next album is going to be this gigantic fucking craziness, but it's really cool. But anyway, those are our music picks. The Mets made some moves. Things are good in the world right now. So go to AmazingAvenue.com, where we're going to have lots more about the Mets over the next few days. Hopefully we can sign Javi Baez. If they do that, then I will never be one of those Uncle Steve guys on Twitter, but
right.
I will tip my hat to the team's commitment to spend to rebuild this team if they can re-sign Javi Baez.
Yeah. Which, yeah, man, for sure.
Based on our podcast history, will happen in about 3 minutes. As soon as we stop recording, they will sign Javi Baez. So you're welcome, listeners. If you're listening to this and they've signed Javi Baez, you're welcome. It's because we signed off the show.
Yes.
So I'll take full credit for that. Anyway, go to AmazingAvenue.com for all sorts of Mets stuff. Follow Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. This podcast is on Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music. Wherever you get podcasts, you can find us. Please rate, review, and subscribe. We appreciate that. Chris is on Twitter at Chris McShane. I am at Brian Aidsonap. And until next time, with 4 new players, including Max fucking Scherzer, let's go Mets.